Folks, this is finally episode two of Shadowboxing the Apocalypse. And I am so excited because guess who I have back? The author of Death of Democracy, Ben Hecht, back on the pod. You guys have waited a long time for this, and let me tell you a little bit about why. Because I wanted to get rolling on some stuff on Twitter called Project 1933. The purpose of this work and this pod today is kind of walk you through how quick the demise of democracy is in the Berlin and Germany in 1933. The perception that we have here is that we've got these institutions, checks and balances, a weak presidential system that's separated powers. We've got courts. We've got all these things. Surely it can't happen here. And I brought on a guy who wrote a whole book about how it happened there. So we can talk and you can see kind of how it could happen here. So, what I'm going to do today in this pod, if you haven't been following Project 1933, this is going to bring you up to speed. We're going to walk through the 60-day period it took for Hitler to consolidate total power and end basically constitutional governments in Germany. And no better person on there than my buddy Ben. Hey, Ben, how's it going?
Hey Rachel, it's good. I'm good. How are you?
It's always a good day to talk about the death of democracy, isn't it, Ben?
Well, I guess, sure.
I guess, right? Well, talk about it we must. And the reason why, if you guys wrap around and if you didn't listen to the first episode of Shadowboxing the Apocalypse, you should go ahead and listen to that because what Ben and I lay out in that podcast is how Nazi propaganda flipped the moral code in Germany around and created victimization amongst the, Nazi party members, Nazi part, party people who would vote for Nazis. And by reversing the victimization paradigm, what that does is it makes your aggressive, illegal seizure of power defensive in nature. And that's how you justify those really, really incredible things like rounding up your political opponents. Because of course, you have to do it to defend the safety of Germany because they're plotting a communist revolution or whatever it might be. So today, Ben, let's talk a little bit about 1933. Okay? It's
Sure.
1933 and we're in Germany and we have just had a presidential election cycle that has produced kind of a series of election cycles, by the way, that has produced another kind of suboptimal outcome in that it didn't create a ruling party, okay? So it requires some coalition forming. And who are the Nazis interested in forming a coalition with then?
Well, the Nazis are interested in getting to a majority, and they're actually quite pragmatic about their politics. They'll form a coalition with more or less anybody who will work. Now, that means they're definitely not interested in forming a coalition with anybody, any parties from the left. So, in Germany in 1933, this means they're not interested in the center-left Social Democrats, and they're super not interested in the far-left communists. Those are the two parties that they most demonize. But anyone else is kind of fair game. They are particularly interested in a party called the German National Party, which is the party that's sort of closest to them ideologically. It's the other kind of really right-wing party. But they're sort of flirting with a party that represents Catholics called the Center Party. And they're kind of flirting with a few smaller kind of somewhat liberal or somewhat conservative parties as well.
And who is Hindenburg and von Papen, who are, Germany's leaders under Weimar? What party are they a member of?
A complicated question in both cases. So Hindenburg, who is the president, the offices are a little complicated. The Weimar had a president sort of like we do, and Germany still does today. But it also had a person called the chancellor, who was sort of the actual real head of an administration. The president had power, but also had more symbolic functions. Paul von Hindenburg is the president. He was Germany's supreme commander in World War I. He's an old soldier. By 1933, he's well into his 80s, but still in pretty good shape physically. He doesn't have a party. Technically, he's nonpartisan, but he clearly is kind of associated with that party called the German National Party, which is the sort of, I wouldn't say center right because they're not really center, but they're kind of like establishment right Their ideology is pretty far right, but they represent sort of the real power elite in Germany. Von Papen, who was chancellor for a while in 1932, and who sort of facilitates Hitler finally becoming chancellor in 1933, von Papen had been with the Catholic Center Party, the party that existed really only to represent German Catholics. But he got kicked out by the Center Party in 1932, basically because he, Papen, had been involved in kicking out the previous chancellor, who had been a chancellor from the Center Party, a guy named Heinrich Brüning. So because of that seemed to be sleazy move, and it was a sleazy move, frankly, the Center Party unloaded
Or
Papen,
you
and
might
so he
even
kind of
call that, Ben, you might even call that move a Mitch McConnell level sleazy move, right?
Kind of. Papen wasn't nearly as smart or cunning as McConnell, but he was about as sleazy. He actually ends up gravitating towards the German nationals, which is kind of where he belongs ideologically.
Right. And they need these guys, right? Because it's with them they can form a majority. Now, kind of their agreement. The Nazis were the plurality vote winners, so they had more votes than anyone, and that was what the argument was about bringing them into the government. But it was with great hesitation because the conservatives wanted to ride the Nazis to power, but they didn't necessarily want them in power, especially because even within the mainstream conservative movement, there was a desire to abandon Weimar democracy and move into an authoritarian model. So they wanted to have that authoritarian structure, and they were kind of willing to entertain the useful idiot that they thought of as the useful idiot in Hitler to get there. So they swear Hitler in to a weak chancellorship. And on that chancellorship is mostly dominated by these establishment conservatives, right? But it is they give them two Nazi new two Nazi cabinet members kind of token recognition. Okay, so here's Hitler. It's January 30th. He's getting sworn in as a weak chancellor. He's basically got token power on the cabinet. Next thing you know, what happens then?
I mean, you're absolutely right. When Hitler comes into power, there are 11 people in his cabinet. He's chancellor. There are 10 others. Only two of them are Nazis. Most of them are establishment conservative figures. They all figure they've got Hitler exactly where they want him. They've got him, they've harnessed him for his vote support, but he has no power. Really, the first important thing that happens that most of the others didn't want is that Hitler gets President Hindenburg to call another election, another parliamentary election. So basically, he's 2 days in office, and then they're off and running on another election campaign, which, by the way, would be the sixth in Germany major national campaign in under a year.
Right.
For the purposes of this election, Hitler and the Nazis are running kind of in coalition with the German National Party, with the view that they'll come out of this with a majority.
Exactly. And instead, what happens?
That does happen, but there's a lot of bumps along the way. I mean, the first thing, one of the early things that happens is Hitler gets von Papen to agree to decrees. We would kind of call them executive orders in our system. They're rather similar to that. Decrees the president can issue to start really cracking down on the opposition. They start
There you go.
limiting, closing down media outlets, newspapers, and so on that support parties that aren't the Nazis or the nationalists. They have the police have the power to break up meetings and rallies being held by other parties. The Nazis are starting to dominate the radio, which is really important in 1933. And super importantly, and something that the establishment conservatives amazingly didn't grasp, is that one of those token Nazis in the cabinet is Hermann Göring, who, along with having a position in the national cabinet, so now Göring is using this police force to go after enemies of the Nazis, and he is starting to incorporate the Nazis' militia, the Nazi stormtroopers and people like that into the police. He's making them temporary officers so they can go after their enemies, who are anyone who is opposing the Nazis. So there's already, just in weeks, there's this incredible accretion of power and this incredible breakdown of the rule of law, like really starting to accelerate. And then we get to the Reichstag fire, which
Okay,
is a super big
but
deal.
before we get there, is exactly what I was trying to lead you into, because the perception is you get a couple of months, you get this big event, they exploit it, blah, blah, blah. But it's really important for folks to understand. There's two things that happen. Number one, the Ministry of Propaganda and Public Enlightenment under Joseph Goebbels is established within, March. Okay. It starts running, it starts controlling the press. This is where you see the very first restrictions on free press has been just laid out. But also they start to make opposition parties illegal. They start to harass the the meetings and really tame down the opposition so that they can maximize what they need in the Reichstag to get to that next step. Now that next step, of course, is going to go into now is the Reichstag fire, which happens, at the end of March and leads to something called the Enabling Act, which is generally what we point to as, the thing that ended up, empowering him as a dictator. So then tell us about what happens with the Reichstag fire and where the what the Nazis do to seize that opportunity.
There being chancellor. So again, how quickly this is happening. And the election campaign is still on. It's a week before the election is going to happen, 6 days actually before the election is going to happen. On a Monday night, suddenly Germany's parliament, the Reichstag, right in the center of Berlin, bursts into flames. And this is a super important event about which there's still quite a bit of controversy. The bit about which there isn't controversy is that Hitler quickly parlays this event into something which enhances his power. Hitler immediately is out front with the story that the fire happened because the communists started it as a first step in a communist coup d'etat against Hitler's new administration. And so he uses this to basically go to President Hindenburg and get another decree, another executive order, called the Reichstag, informally called the Reichstag Fire Decree. It actually formally is called the Decree of President von Hindenburg for the Safety of State and People. But what's important is what the decree does, which it gives the Nazis basically unlimited power of arrest and basically guts the whole list of rights in the Constitution, right to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, rights against arbitrary arrest and detention, security of the mail, all that kind of stuff. So the Nazis have basically limitless police power now. It also, very importantly, Germany's a federal country then and now. It gives the national government the power to take over a state government, which is
Right.
super important. If you think about how this would work in America, if like the federal government could take over like the government
Right.
of the state of California, for instance, that'd be a big deal. And that's one of the things that this decree also does. So, most historians say this decree really makes Hitler a dictator. So literally 4 weeks into his time in office, he has been transformed out of recognition from a guy in quite a weak political position when he comes into office on the 30th of January to on the 28th of February in the immediate wake of the fire to being really meaningfully a dictator. The bit that's a mystery and which I must confess is fascinating to me, and I wrote a whole book about this, is the question of who actually set the fire, about which
Right.
historians still argue. To most people who aren't and weren't Nazis, it seemed kind of intuitive. You always ask in a detective story, right? Who benefits? Cui bono? And it's clearly the Nazis who benefit, so it looks logical that it's the Nazis who did it. But since World War II, many historians came to believe, for complicated and, in my view, largely fraudulent reasons, that it's kind of like the JFK assassination, that this crazy Dutch guy named Marinus van der Lubbe, who was kind of mentally handicapped and about 80% vision impaired, somehow broke into the building and set this massive fire by himself, which actually for a whole string of reasons is basically inconceivable. But many historians still believe that, van der Lubbe acted alone and there was no Nazi conspiracy. I think the Nazis did do it, and I wrote a book sort of setting out the evidence for that. But I have to say, full disclosure, not every historian is convinced of this, and there are still historians who think it was, van der Lubbe who did it himself. In any case, we do know for sure what Hitler made of this and the use he made of it in getting this decree, which, again, 4 weeks into his time in office and 6 days before the election that he's hoping will give him a majority, he's already a dictator.
And let me make it clear for the listeners too, like why, the reason that that lie works so well is we're not talking, we're talking about Germany in 1933. It's about 15, 16 years out or whatever, 20 years out from the Bolshevik Revolution. And communism is a vibrant party in many Western democracies, right? So it's not like here where there are no communists, right? But what matters is perception, right? So whether or not they did it on purpose, they were prepared to use it as the catalyst to get this, enabling act passed. And when they passed the enabling act, guys, you should understand it passed because all the opposition, the communists were already outlawed, and I think the social democrats voted against it, but they all ended up in jail too, right? So it's
Yeah,
not
I
like
think it's
so,
important. Sorry, let me just mention, because it's important to sort of keep tabs on this. So the Reichstag fire is the night of February 27th. The decree, the Reichstag fire decree, comes February 28th. This is like an executive order in American terms. It's a decree. What we call the Enabling Act comes almost a month later, and it's after the election has happened, which actually, by the way, the Nazis were disappointed in their election outcome. It's important, I think, to keep this in mind. They got 43% of the vote. Very good in the German system, but they had sort of thought they would win a majority on their own. They only have a majority because of their coalition partners, the nationalists, who get 8%. So they're just squeaking into a majority at 51%, basically. And you're quite right. In the parliamentary arithmetic, when they do this on March 23rd, again, to keep the timeline in mind, as you were saying, Rachel, and I think it's excellent, how fast the timeline is. So it's March 23rd, the vote in the Reichstag to pass the Enabling Act. And you're right, the communists by that time are the communist members of parliament, of which there were a lot. They were getting between 10 and 15% of the vote at this point. They're all either dead or in concentration camps or out of Germany. There's really no other possibility for a communist deputy at that point. And you're right, the Social Democrats, 94, I think, of them in the House voted against, very brave. A lot of them were being beaten or tormented or sent to concentration camps too. But their leader gave an incredibly brave speech, looking Hitler right in the eye and saying, "No enabling act can give you the power to trample principles that are true and eternal." A great speech. He deserves more credit than he gets for that. But Hitler got the act. I mean, he needed a two-thirds vote because it was a constitutional amendment, and he got a two-thirds vote because the other parties basically chickened out and went with him. There's no nice way to say this. And so, very importantly, what the Enabling Act did is it sort of completes what the Reichstag fire decree had started. Under the Enabling Act, the Reichstag voted to give Hitler's administration all of the Reichstag's lawmaking powers for 4 years. So again, it's like, imagine if Congress basically votes to give the president all ability to make laws for 4 years. That's basically what the Enabling Act does. So if Hitler wasn't a dictator after the Reichstag fire, he sure as hell a dictator on March 23rd with the Enabling Act. And at that point, it's kind of done.
So basically the low and the ho of it is this. Okay, you have a country, it's a very turbulent democracy. It's not, it doesn't have 250 year embedded institutions and blah blah blah. But it's got the rule of law, it's got a court system, it's got a federalist system that divides power between the federal and state system. And it's almost like none of that stuff could save Germany. Because as long as you've got two things, you can just ignore or suspend the law. One, you have to have a leader willing to ignore or announce the law as suspended. And two, you have to have a supporting cast willing to play along and like formalize that power through some kind of process. And that's, voting to give lawmaking power to the president in our system. It certainly seems like the safeguards that people would have thought were pretty good didn't hold up to the stress test of having somebody willing to just ignore the law.
Yes. And I think it's worth mentioning on that, Rachel, that lots of Germans in January and February 1933, before this process had really run its course, said a lot of the same stuff, about checks and balances and guardrails and so on that Americans say now. Lots of Germans said, "Well, look, President Hindenburg is there. Who is a bigger guarantee of stability than this, like, great old figure?" Or, the army. At the end of the day, the army matters for power. The army's going to be totally loyal to Hindenburg, so they're not going to let Hitler do anything with them. And all those establishment conservative politicians that we talked about who were in Hitler's cabinet, everybody said, "Well, look, these are experienced leaders. They'll keep a rein on Hitler." So there was this real complacency about what Hitler's administration would bring. And then, as we've seen, incredibly quickly, in under 2 months, in about 6 weeks, basically, Hitler has overturned the whole thing and basically undone all of those guardrails and made himself a dictator.
Yep, and it, why I'm trying to highlight to folks that number one, the timeline is Benjamin just reestablished. I mean, this is within 2 months of, being sworn in as a weak chancellor that you see this power consolidation. And in the next episodes of this Shadow Box in the Apocalypse, what we're going to look at next is life in the Third Reich. Okay, so what happens 60 days later when you wake up and now you realize you've got a problem? Okay, Houston, you've got a problem, but guess what? You waited until it was so obvious. All the mechanisms and tools and things that you might have done to avert this crisis, those are no longer viable. There is no free press. There is no constitutional separation of lawmaking versus law execution, right? There are prison camps. I mean, Dachau opens up, I believe, on March 15th, guys. March 15th. So he's sworn in January 30th. And by March 15th, if you happen to be a communist political leader or even a vocal social democrat, you may well have found your butt sitting in Dachau concentration camp within,
And not just
60.
those things, by the way. You could be a priest who has sort of humane views on things. You could be, a writer, an artist, a kind of liberal intellectual. You could be a lawyer who defended people the Nazis didn't like. These were the people who were in Dachau when it opened in March, as you say. And again, March, think about this. Like Hitler's chancellor on January 30th. In March, Dachau, one of the most notorious concentration camps, is opened. And there's no secret about it. It's in the papers, like big headlines,
Right.
concentration camp opens at Dachau,
Yeah, I've seen some reporting, and you'll guess where from, New York Times, in which they, sent some reporters there and talked about all the recreational time these wonderful political prisoners who were, by the way, I think the first Jews are murdered in Dachau around this time. It is not much longer. And, the court system tries to answer that because you're in this transitional model between the old democracy and the new fascist dictatorship. And if folks think if Trump wins, they're going to wake up the next day and it's going to be obvious they've lost everything. No, it's a slow and subtle transition, not that slow we see in Germany, but it's such that it happens and you're like the next thing you know, you're hearing headlines of Democratic political leaders like Hillary Clinton or whoever falling under the axe of this Nazi government. So it was really important to bring Ben back on. Ben, I hope you're willing to come back on. The next episode we're going to do is going to focus on what happens under this dictatorship to the average people, to the people who, may or may not have voted for Hitler, and what life looks like for Jews, especially in this emerging new Nazi dictatorship. So thanks for coming on today.
Sure. Well, thank you. Great to be with you.